Hey, we're here today on Center Maryland's The Lobby Pod. We are fortunate to have one of my favorite humans operating in the Maryland governance and policy space. That's Tom Cole. Welcome, Tom Cole.
I am now on one of my favorite podcasts, which I've told you. I have a small selection of must-listen podcasts where whenever they come out, I might be listening to a longer podcast. I'll switch over to this one. And so it is an honor to be on The Lobby.
That's kind. And if you told me that at 48 years old or whatever I am, that I would have some 30, 40 something Calvert Hall graduate as my muse in Tom Cole, I would be very confused.
Go Hall.
I did not do an introduction because I thought I would just get completely lost in my praise of you, as can happen with me. But right out of the gate, I want to tell you two things. One, I'm so excited about you becoming a partner at this extremely well-respected firm in Maryland, Perry White Ross Jacobson. You got an extraordinary team there. Can you talk a little bit about how you found yourself at Perry White?
Yeah, I mean, those guys are the best. For many reasons, but one of which is they share my philosophy, which is that when you're going to do this work, when you're going to be down advocating in Annapolis and also across the state, you know, I do a lot of work in the counties across the state, your relationships matter more than the project you're working on. And there are a lot of great people in Annapolis and many of them share those values, but that was critical to me. You know, I've been friends with Jonas Jacobson for quite a while now, and he is really one of the most genuine people that does this work. And when I was deciding whether or not to make the move, because I'm a land use and zoning attorney continuing to do that, had been doing that, it was a big move for me. But knowing that they shared that philosophy was critical to that decision-making. And so getting to learn from Tim Perry and Josh White and Eddie Pounds, all those folks that are down there. You know, I've only been on the job for a couple of weeks now, but I really do feel at home, and I do feel like I'm taking a roster spot on the All-Star team.
You know, you really set out to burnish a reputation as a subject matter expert, I think. And when I say set out to, I don't mean in a vainglorious way. I just mean like there's a huge gap where people are having major conversations about things like housing and transportation, but very few people in those conversations, especially online, are subject matter experts. So you filled this enormous hole, I think, over the last 10 years and have become one of the leading thought leaders in housing and land use in one of the most competitive, you know, real estate markets in the United States, in the DMV. And I'm wondering, you know, as a local land use counsel, and I used to hate when people would call me like a local expert or something, like I could never rise to anything further than local, but you know, if you're in transportation, if you're in housing, you know that you really can't move all the levers until you have a platform that allows the state to get more involved in these conversations. Like, education wants to change at the local level. Guess how it's going to do it? It's going to do it with a Kerwin or a Blueprint, which is a state policy that empowers local jurisdictions to do great things. Same thing here in housing. I'm just wondering, with Lisa Bianco going on at the federal level, all this amazing stimulus money that's coming down, it just seems to me like it was a proper growth platform for somebody that wants to make real change in housing, transportation, and land use across the state of Maryland and the DMV.
Yeah, I mean, the opportunity was one that I couldn't look away from. And the response has been really amazing. Just many of the people that I had already been working with in the housing space coming to me and broadening the representation. But then also folks that had been paying attention to a lot of my advocacy related to housing policy connecting back with me and saying, well, now that you're in this space, and listen, the firm has been working in housing for a long time. It's not just me that makes them be able to address this. As a matter of fact, many of the biggest movers in housing were already clients before I started. But how I've said is, we are reaching the point where when it comes to housing policy, it can't just be on the defensive. It can't just be not making things worse. Those that understand that housing is fundamental to everything our state faces, you need to get on a offensive posture. We need to start re-examining many of the biggest obstacles to housing production as it relates to local control, where all of the political incentives are upside down, the generational wealth transfer that we are allowing to happen by inertia as housing supply is constrained and the generations that are comfortably housed see their wealth increase, while those who do not have housing or historically disadvantaged communities who have not had the opportunity for home ownership, that gap, we are facilitating that gap by inertia. And the only way we are going to have a state that doesn't leave anyone behind is by taking on housing policy first. If zip code is destiny, if we're going to have some of the best school systems in the country that are not accessible to people because they can't afford to live there, we need to change that. And so I expect in the years ahead, and I hope that I have the opportunity to be a part of this, we are going to change from just not making it worse to actually making it better and making Maryland a leader in housing supply and addressing the housing crisis.
Now, look, the problem with being a thought leader, Tom, is that when you come on here, I got to ask you about current events. You know, this thing,
I'm ready for it.
This thing will probably publish in a couple days. There's been some major appointments out there that I'd love to get your take on. You've been pretty public about. One is Governor Moore's appointment of Salisbury Mayor Jake Day to be Secretary of Housing. Talk to me about what this means for Maryland, what this means for the DMV.
Wow. I mean, just the visionary leadership of seeing what Jake Day had done in Salisbury and deciding that that is someone the governor needed to have on his team. Jake not only has the courage to do what's necessary, but he also has the policy understanding. I mean, Jake is a policy wonk on housing, but he also, in addition to that knowledge, in addition to that courage, has humility to bring in different voices to help him figure out where the state needs to improve. I couldn't be more excited about his selection. And I mean, to have someone that's coming into the position of Secretary of DHCD who has said he wants to be a policy leader in that position, whereas in the past, this secretarial position was mostly just facilitating the distribution of housing vouchers, of LIHTC funds, low-income housing tax credit funds, all very important programmatic aspects. But for someone to say, we need to do more and we need to be more in that space, I do not think there is anyone better in the state. Or I would even say, and maybe I'm getting over my skis on this, I would even say across the country, just because Jake...
I love that I'm not the only guy that says across the country. So please, carry on.
Well, I mean, when I'm saying that, you've got a mayor who undertook initiatives that resulted in a significant increase in housing production in a short period of time and had a program to do it, implemented that program. There's many people that might write books. There's many people that might pass laws, but you rarely have the person that reads the book and passes the law and does it in a short period of time and shows a product as a result of it. And so, you know, I think that
does that give him credibility? Like, we're hearing in Prince George's County, the economic engine of Maryland. I'm here to tell you, They're talking about no more townhouses, no more two over two condominiums or product like that in, you know, the biggest, most one of the most important counties in the whole DMV. Talk to me. Do you think because of his experience that he has a unique credibility to join hands with leaders in that a jurisdiction like that and show them that we don't have to approach this from sort of a fear experience? You know, is there, what kind of element does the state secretary of housing with his background, don't you think they can add a little courage to the local leaders that are having struggles managing their own constituencies who might just have a straight sort of NIMBY view? Or, hey, Prince George's County, we're the most elite county in the state. We're one of the most elite counties in the country. We're going to act like an elite county and shut people out. When in fact, it's a time for them to be, you know, pulling people together and including and proving to the world that's how it's done, in my view.
I mean, the credibility point is, if you heard me before saying that local government is one of our biggest obstacles to housing production, he was a mayor. So he can talk to these jurisdictions and say, I know you're saying this, but this is the housing crisis as I see it. Housing is infrastructure. You're not going to stop your population growth by stopping housing. What is the real concern that you have when you're making these policy decisions? And how can we meet that somewhere else? And be able to advocate amongst the other department heads. You know, in Prince George's County, the state is making a significant investment in mass transportation. Those are the places that we should be looking to put more of the missing middle housing. But also, I think Prince George's County has some legitimate objections as it relates to, is every other county doing its part to address the housing crisis as well? And listen, right, the housing crisis is zip code specific. There are many people that hear me say things like the housing crisis, and they say, well, there are vacant units in Baltimore City, or there's open farmland in Carroll County. That is not a real position. That is a fake.
Tell me why. Tell me why.
Because where we need the most housing, particularly affordable housing, are in high opportunity areas. And the high opportunity areas, they are attracting people, whether or not we build a unit. If you look at the search results of many countries across the world, places like Howard County, Montgomery County, Prince George's County show up in those search results for where they want to live in the United States. And that's not even counting inside the United States. So the only way you can stop population growth is by making it a less desirable place to live. No one's willing to do that. No one's trying to make any of these counties a less desirable place to live. So just like we need to build schools and we need to build roads and we need to build water and sewer, we need to build housing. It is to accommodate the population growth that's already coming. Because if we don't, what happens is those people move to the jurisdiction anyway. They live in smaller places. They live in less safe places. They live in under terms that nobody would want them to live, because they are so desperate to make sure that their family has the quality of life, the opportunities that zip code creates. And so where you see vacant housing, that's where people have decided that is not a good place to live. It is a basic human instinct. And meanwhile, you will see people in substandard living conditions in some of the prettiest places in Maryland because they've decided that's how they can level up for the next generation. And so that's what we all need to understand when it comes to housing. It's not simply moving pieces around on the board and say, well, we got some room over here. It's not an Amazon warehouse. Maryland has people live where people want to live. And so we need to build housing in those places.
Was that just the most beautiful dig at the Commonwealth of Virginia, or am I just too much into things?
Maybe. I mean, those buildings over there are very pretty. It's a shame that they're going to be half completed.
talked about appointments. You were a huge resource to the reporters and journalists at the Washington Post and the Baltimore Sun when they were all trying to figure out a way to save our Baltimore Sun. You became a friendly and close advisor with our friend Ted Venatoulis through that pursuit. And he has a dear friend who is up for nomination. Her name is Yolanda Maria Martinez. She is a dynamic businesswoman who has, you know, led the 2-1-1 effort here in Maryland. She was on the Maryland Auto Board. I served with her there. She did a remarkable job. She's coming into some headwinds after a Maryland Matters story by the world famous writer of The Wire, actually in the second season, Bill Zorzi. It's a very serious investigation about her past and her, you know, some financial difficulties dating back to 1988, I think. Just love to hear, like, the way I approach politics is very simple. And I would say I've known Maria. I worked alongside with her on some of the biggest boards in the state of Maryland. She's a great talent, a great friend. I vouch for her. Well, you know, that's good that I vouch for her and she's got half the state vouching her. But I just wonder from a policy standpoint, why you think her appointment straights are important and what the Senate should do about it.
Yeah. I mean, as I've said and will say, if we're going to make a standard that having financial troubles in your past and having a bankruptcy in your past disqualifies you from government service, even on a board like the Maryland Stadium Authority, then we are self-selecting for generational wealth. Because people that have bad decision-making, but have mommy and daddy's bank account to fall back on, aren't going to have that in their background. And they might come across as a sterling resume, but they're not the people that you want on that board. You want people like Maria Martinez. And I've also, so I don't have the same personal relationship, but I've seen Maria in action. I've seen her on Main Street in Ellicott City, where after Main Street had two back-to-back floods, we experienced COVID-19 with everybody else. But it was all that more severe because they were coming out of those two tragedies. And Maria Martinez went and helped. I have a particular anecdote as it relates to a group of barbers who, you know, that was very hard on that profession because they're all independent contractors. They're not really on a paycheck, so it can't get protected under a paycheck protection program. She helped set them up with a new shop when they didn't really have the capital to invest in that place. She had the space. She helped them get their equipment. She helped them start a business.
So that whole beautiful barbershop thing on Main Street there?
Yeah. She had a big hand in. OEC Barbers. You can look them up now. I highly recommend them. They're great people.
He would know. Tom's got a lot of facial hair, folks, so he would know.
You know, during the masking times, I couldn't get it trimmed. I had to do it on my own. It was not pretty. But, you know, I saw her do that in a selfless way. And I heard from the barbers themselves speak about Maria in a selfless way. And when I contrast that against, and I love my friends at Maryland Matters, I didn't think that was a very good piece. I, you know, when you have things, when you're referring to ski masks, but then you don't follow that up and say whether any charges were filed, right, you're really just trying to create an image in the reader's mind of this is a bad person. You're trying
or
to
that,
create,
you know,
those.
Or that 1988 bankruptcy, she was tied to a husband and partner who ultimately was convicted for abuse charges against her. And you know how financial abuse is tied to verbal abuse, is tied to physical abuse. It's all one thing.
Yeah.
That was 1988, man. I was in eighth grade and I'm an old man in this business. And that's right. What we're talking about. Meanwhile, a very popular governor, I think he had like Larry Hogan. I think he had like three or four bankruptcies. You know, we have all this like hustle. They call it, you know, all these hustle Instagram things. Don't be afraid to fail. All these kids are going out to California and Austin, Texas, learning how to be an entrepreneur and start up and not be afraid to fail. If you fail, what do? You go up and start again. And we're going to punish that mentality.
Yeah.
And Maryland, for a Latino woman, get out of here.
And to build on that, you know, you are saying something to the public even when you're not saying it explicitly, when you're holding someone like Maria Martinez up and saying, you know, no matter what else good you might do in your life, you are defined by your worst days, because all of us have had our worst days. And there are some that those worst days are worse than others. And to create that kind of distance between those people and our government is really harmful. People don't fully consider how disaffected people respond in a democracy. And when you tell them that this is not for them, it means the laws that are passed are illegitimate. It means the police that are enforcing those laws are illegitimate. So it is while we're talking about Maria Martinez and we're talking about her background, there is a larger message that I want to give the governor explicit credit for standing by his appointee. He certainly could have, and his staff certainly could have, backed down. But I think he understands more than most, more than any, that standing by someone like Maria Martinez is critical for that reason alone. If you're going to say leave no one behind, it means regardless of your background. And it means that you might even be more valuable because you've had that background. Because when you're going into a meeting, a hearing of the Maryland Stadium Authority, and you've had your challenges in the past, you're not just going to look for the person in the cleanest and nicest suit and give them the deal that they're asking for, but rather you're going to say, who's not at this table? Who's in my position back when I was on my worst day, and where are they? And that's why it's so important. And I understand the Senate is taking its time, but it's so important.
That's their job. You know, they're the brakes. Yeah. That's their job. I get it.
Right. The cooling saucer of Maryland, essentially. And
but they got time to decide to do it right, right?
Right, right. And let's just hope it goes through. And I've been so heartened to see, when I saw Maria was being held up, I was just like, hey, I've got a platform. I'm going to say some things because I don't want good deeds to be ignored. But I've been so excited to see all of the people that are coming to her defense, because I don't think that you can interact with Maria and not realize that she is a genuine and good person. And I think we're seeing that with the passage of time.
Tell me what you want to do with this practice, Tom Cole. I know I'm going to get into your bio in a couple minutes, but I'd love just to hear about, you know, what you would like to do in this practice. You got a great federal partner now. They teamed you up also with Lisa Bianco as a new partner over there. Steny Hoyer's right-hand person, and I must say, was somebody with some awesome Colorado roots. But, you know, there's so much interlinkaging of opportunities now between the federal and the state and local government. It seems like the firm is gearing up to be a platform to serve at the highest levels at every level.
Yeah, I mean, big credit to the strategic thinking with that. Lisa Bianco is amazing. Her background, being counsel to the January 6th committee, all of the networks that she has in Washington, D.C., really just augments the work that the firm has already been doing to a degree that I don't think we can even imagine right now. And to be able to have that partnership, and that's a little bit of my focus with my practice in a different direction, whereas I go even more local. Baltimore County, Howard County, Anne Arundel County, Baltimore City, to be able to have, and yes, our partners have been doing local lobbying well before I came around, but for my goal is to offer integrated services from the county to the state, obviously state representation as well, but then you have Lisa at the federal level. So there really isn't a part where we have to let our clients walk out the door and not have an integrated representation of all of their needs and all the concerns that they might have. And because of that, we can be a little bit more ambitious in the things that we're taking on. As I mentioned before, as it relates to housing, I think it's time that we go on the offense a little bit more and really elevate the value of housing. I'm very fortunate that I have some great solar clients. That is gonna be a big emphasis as our energy portfolio has a greater needs for renewable energy. And as our governor has just made an ambitious goal of electric vehicles, well, that is going to have a lot of pressure on the grid. And so renewable energy, wind energy,
Steer
in
Howard
energy.
County, right? Are they tied?
What's that?
You got Steer in Howard County?
I know that. I mean, I think that those are future technologies that are just going to come online, you know, as we go forward. But I love what I do because, and whatever people might think about lobbyists, if you get paid $1 for your time speaking to an elected official, you're a lobbyist. I get to speak to elected officials every day on behalf of my clients about things that I care about. We get to decide what clients we take. That's a privilege that not everybody has. And
reach
to be able to build a practice around the things I care about most, representing clients that are doing good work and that are being ambitious in what they're trying to do, you know, make no small plans. That is the most exciting and invigorating work that I can ever imagine. So being able to go and be aggressive, not just be on defense, but be on offense, get legislation evaluated and passed that takes on some of the biggest problems that Maryland has going forward, that I understand we all see, but as it sometimes relates to the solutions, we get a little bit caught up. And with a governor like Wes Moore, and with the leadership that we have in Annapolis with Speaker Jones and Senate President Ferguson, I think that now is going to be opening up Maryland's best decade in terms of taking these things on.
Talk to me about the elements. I think the elements of your career that make you so attractive to one of the top firms in the whole region is your, not only your thought leadership, but your tackling of the media environment. We already talked about how you work to save the traditional media and the Baltimore Sun, but I talked about your inspiration being a muse to me as really the first, in my view, public affairs podcaster in the state of Maryland. You named it Elevate Maryland. I believe you lived up to your mission, and you also kept true to your local roots in Howard County and always highlighting. I think you elevated Howard County much the way like a Guy Gazzoni does in the legislature, you did in the media sphere. Can you talk to me a little bit about your experience with Elevate Maryland and Candace Dotson Reed? Not by accident, I'm sure you found yourself with one of the most superior bigs in all of Maryland. Just can you talk to me a little bit about that process and what you learned from it, what drove you crazy about it? And just give me a sense of, it's a brave thing to go out there. You know, I had to watch guys like you go out and do it to get the courage to just do it myself. And so I want to thank you for that, but I also would love to hear some of your fun moments, your stresses, just a little behind the scenes of Elevate Maryland.
Yeah. So Candace Dotson Reed, this was her idea. It was her idea to create this podcast back in 2015. And
you are a good lobbyist, man.
I remain forever thankful that she thought my.
So she's my muse. That makes more sense to me.
Yes. Yeah. She's your muse. I'm the muse's apprentice. but it all relates back to a philosophy that I've had since I was in my 20s, which is that if you try to hide, if you try to make yourself small, other people will define you. And so what I've always tried to do is there's really not anything about me that people don't know. There's not anything about my views on things. There's not really much about my life that people don't know. And that's not to be an exhibitionist, but it's because if I'm going to be involved in this business, I want to be transparent with people. I want people to be able to say they know where I am on things. Elevate Maryland in my personal journey was a evolutionary step from having a local blog for 6 years, where every day at 5 o'clock in the morning, I would write about local news stories. And that was back when local media was much more robust than it is now. But having that blog set me on the path that I am now, just in terms of engaging with people and talking to people and not only knowing what I think, but knowing what other people think. I know that my work on housing is not popular, at least not popular in the same people that are involved in local government. It's popular on a poll, but it's not popular on that insular group of people that are heavily involved in local government. But people still engage with me, and I would like to think respect me, because I don't hide it. I think that a lot of people that are involved in housing advocacy, particularly zoning attorneys, do themselves a disservice by being small, because and hiding, because there's just the presumption of corruption when people can't see and understand what you're doing. So Elevate Maryland.
That's a great point.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you can extend that out.
The old Peter O'Malley, for not the Martin O'Malley, Peter O'Malley, but the Peter O'Malley from Prince George's, who is sort of the leading public citizen there. And I think in his obituary or in one of the final Post pieces, Washington Post pieces about him, he said, it's difficult to engage in service and public service because of the constant barrage of attacks about the assumption of corruption. Mm-hmm. And he just said he is tired of it. And so after he did the arena deal in DC, he said, I'm not doing this stuff anymore. So I'm interested in that. And so when you're online, you're not look at me, you're like, look at us. This is what we do every day. This is our lives. This is the community I live in. These are the causes I support, like the Science Center. This is what I do, right?
Yeah. I mean, and also like when I'm feeling a little bit more caustic, I say, if you believe there's been corruption, here is the FBI hotline. Call them. I mean,
that's a little too Gary Hart for me, but I'll take it.
But the issue is that people, yeah. There are two different categories of people that get involved in politics. One are people that care about the issues, that are fascinated by the issues, and are fascinated about the machinations of what happens when different interest groups and different advocacy groups interact with each other. That's the group I want to be a part of. There's also the group that just likes bullying people and just likes saying nasty personal things about other people. And that group just went right from high school to this. And they really don't have anything substantive to say about the issues, but they call out corruption. They look at campaign finance reports and they just presume it's pay to play. And they're not, you could not talk to them about a policy paper because they are so fixated on the personalities of politics. And so my view is that if we're going to be loud about the policy issues, it helps the elected officials, because then the elected officials can be seen and interact with that environment instead of making excuses for why someone that they might not know that well gave them $6,000, which on the grand scheme of things, while $6,000 is a lot of money to any family, $6,000 is not enough to go to jail. And so when people are saying, oh, there's corruption because they got this amount of money in their campaign account, no one is going to live in a cement box because they accepted $6,000 to approve some kind of zoning petition. That it is just not realistic. And I think the people that fixate on that are really, they've got some things to work out themselves that have nothing to do with politics.
Yes, I agree with that. But it's also strange for those people and anybody that follows Maryland politics with such enthusiasm, you know, and you can demur on this question if you want, but to watch Larry Hogan over the last 8 years go into Baltimore and tut-tut everybody about corruption, and then to see on CBS National News a national manhunt for, you know, one of his statesmen, one of his right-hand people, his top chief of staff, Roy McGrath, is missing. And it's all tied to a federal corruption trial, you know, and that guy was at 76% approval rating, tut-tutting Prince George's County and Baltimore City about corruption. All the while, you know, he's got the biggest, ugliest corruption matter in the entire DMV for the last 10 years sitting right on his lap. And, you know, that kind of stuff makes it difficult for everybody trying to do good work and good government.
Yeah. And he's not being held to account for that. And he would have been held to account if and when this trial ever happens, having, you know, a text messaging app that automatically deleted text messages. And among those text messages were him talking about circling the wagons around Roy McGrath when these allegations originally came forward. I think that our conversation on crime is broken, as demonstrated by this instance where a governor who proudly stood with his arms crossed in front of a thin blue line flag
Reach.
Has the most high profile manhunt in a federal criminal prosecution that we've seen in recent memory. I don't know where Roy McGrath is. I hope that
we pray for him. We know. I
hope that they find him safe. But simultaneous with this, our former governor is on Twitter talking about harsher punishments for Baltimore City crime.
That's sick.
Yeah, it's gross. And
what's grosser, that he says it or that we just let it fly? We just, everybody just lets it.
Damien, I don't think you and I let it fly. Maybe other people do. That's not my style. And, you know, reflecting back on my comment before, because I've had this sort of thrown back at me, is, oh, you say you're not about personal politics, but then you attack Larry Hogan. It's Larry Hogan's entire shtick is that he's a politician above politics, but he's really just playing a piano of outrage, and he knows how to hit the right buttons to make the right people angry. He knows that he can take money out of Baltimore City that was set aside for the Red Line and invest it in highways in the suburbs, and no one's going to call him out for it, and his approval rating is going to increase because the people in Baltimore City that experienced that disinvestment were already not his people, quotes, okay. And the people that he's sending that money to are proud Democrats, lifelong Democrats, who can see that highway expanding and say, well, you know what? It's going to be a little quicker for me to get to work. And so he gets away with this stuff mostly because of what's broken about much of our politics. Like, he blames, quote, partisan politics, but really he just blames being called out for that stuff. He's accused our General Assembly of having beach week. He called our Maryland educators thugs. He called Dan Cox, one of his own people, QAnon whack job. Like, right. What is it about our dialogue? What is it about our political discussion that's wrong, Larry Hogan, that you haven't done yourself? And so now Roy McGrath is really just more the same. Those of us that have seen it are used to it by now. And everybody else is saying, oh, well, why is Larry Hogan accountable for Roy McGrath running away? It's like, this is a guy who wanted to be chief of staff, pretty much the next most important person in the execution of state government.
Who knew him for decades.
Known him for decades. And that's who he selected. I think that speaks to who Larry Hogan was as a governor much more than approval ratings that don't say much in terms of actual accomplishments.
I told you I wasn't going to be able to get all this in. Talk to me about the WBA. I've got 5 minutes left with you. I promise, 8:45. Talk to me about the WBAL gig, because that to me was going from Elevate Maryland. I remember when you were submitting columns for us at Center Maryland, we were so grateful. We were busy with work and everything. We couldn't even publish them because we were just so lost in our work. And then to see you do Elevate Maryland, and now to go onto the flagship radio station in Maryland at WBAL and doing that as somebody who has been a loyal and faithful progressive Democrat over the last 8 years, when everybody in the influence game was sort of shuffling away from their Democratic bona fides, you know, you dug in and then ultimately end up as that voice on Baltimore's most powerful radio station. Talk to me about that experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an honor to have that opportunity on Saturdays. And, you know, I spent a lot of my youth listening to talk radio, and the deliberative process that happens on the radio is, again, when you allow it to happen. I think some people approach the microphone knowing everything that they're going to say. I try to approach it with some curiosity, and I do find a unique honor in addressing a somewhat more conservative listenership with more progressive liberal ideas. and being able to engage in a dialogue there.
I thought I was a tough guy because I could walk through the Baltimore Country Club locker room during the Bob Ehrlich, Martin O'Malley days. That ain't nothing compared to being a Democrat on WBAL as a Saturday morning.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny sometimes because some of the other folks that are on the radio just think that I aspire to be a daytime host, and that's not my goal. My goal is to do what I do. I do not go on the radio for the money. I go on the radio because I think that there is some civic virtue in having these kind of long form conversations about what's going on. And you know, it is something that every time I approach with some matter of reverence, because this is a public service, to be able to have these conversations and do it in a way that makes things better. I'm very honored that many of my most loyal listeners are conservatives, and they say, I love listening to you despite the fact that you have ideas that are very different than me.
Yeah, I mean, we hear David Brooks on public radio or public television, and even, you know, a strident Democrat has to appreciate that point of view. You're doing that here in the inverse with WBAL. Talk to me what the collegiality is like amongst those hosts. It seems like a rare work environment. So, you know, so many work environments are competitive. I'm sure there's some of that there, but they seem to share like a us against the world sort of bon ami or something. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, they could not have been more welcoming. That the culture there is a great culture. Certainly gotten better with some recent changes with some of the hosts over there. But it is an art. And I think that that's where the collegiality comes from, where being able to put on a good radio program, regardless of what you're talking about and the viewpoints you have, that is an art. And so I get to study some of the best with C4 and Brian Niemann and see how they craft their show and how they manage audiences and things like that. You know, and to be in that same category of people, you know, sometimes I show up on the same website as them, is just a great honor, because regardless of what we're actually talking about, the ability to communicate and tackle tough policy issues while you are going live across, you know, miles and miles of radio span, that is something that we all have together.
Folks that listen to podcasts, you know and love Dan Carlin for his hardcore history, but he was once a talk radio host, and he'll tell you all about the ups and downs of that. You get to see that kind of talent now with Tom Cole on WBAL on Saturday morning, and he'll be doing his he'll be doing his Dan Carlin hardcore history podcast that millions of people will be listening to 10 years from now. I promise you. So catch him now on WBAL, and then if you have any questions about the Maryland political space or the regional housing situation in all of the DMV, or you have questions about how the local government in your jurisdiction is handling things, Tom Cole is going to be your man to see.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate that. And you know, you say I'm your muse, but in many ways, I've looked up to you for most of my career. You know, you've taken every lunch with me, had every happy hour with me. And I know I've said this to you before, you know, you look out for people. And I think that that's something that in Maryland in particular, having someone that looks out for other people, regardless of whether or not they're going to get anything back in return, I'd try to model that after you. So I appreciate what you do. And again, this is one of my favorite podcasts now. So it's a great honor to be on here with you today.
What is cool for me to see about you is that when I was going through a journey not unlike yours, I just found it to be so competitive, even within my own circle of people, even within my own firm, so competitive. And for me, I'm more of a collaborative guy, that creates so much anxiety and tension that really crippled me from doing 50% more. And so when I see somebody like you doing what you are doing and facing the challenges that you face when you are open and transparent. You know, all I'm doing is just to try to make sure that you'd have as little of worry about that anxiety as I do. That's all I'm trying to do. And you are naturally inclined to not be anxious, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
But that's all I'm trying to do, man.
I appreciate it, brother. Well, you're the best at that.
All right. Thank you, Tom Cole, for joining us on Center Maryland. This is the Lobby Pod.